This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, so this week in evolutionary psychology news, a study last year from Texas Christian University found that women actually find men more desirable when they are around other women. So in this experiment, women were shown pictures of a couple standing close together, and they were told that the woman in the couple was either an adopted sister, cousin, current girlfriend, or an ex-girlfriend. Then the women rated the man for differing levels of attractiveness and desirability scales. And turns out, surprise, surprise, the guy with the girlfriend was rated higher in everything. Next was the guy standing next to the ex-girlfriend, and then the other two, the related women. So then the experiment was repeated using a picture of the guy just by himself, and of course, women rated him much lower. So the scientists who studied this, the thinking here is that the women are using other women's judgment to assume unobservable qualities of a male, thus raising the male's mate value. And the term for this is called female mate choice copying. Now, keep in mind, one aspect that was not studied was whether this applies to short-term dating or long-term dating. Now, the authors, when asked about this, believe that this effect is most pronounced in long-term dating, simply because women place a much greater priority on unobservable qualities in men in long-term dating rather than in short-term dating. So, Dr. Lyle, what do you think about this?
I'm going to have to go back and change my Match.com profile. Yeah, actually, it's actually obvious, and I think that things like this have been done before. So I'm surprised that this is news. It seems like I've seen this before, but maybe I didn't. But certainly the concept has been around for a long time, and we were quite confident that effect was there. So I don't think this effect surprised anybody. The first time I remember reading about this effect was actually in Tropical Fish. So the authors of the study, this was probably done, I can't remember when it was. I think it was in the 1990s. It might have been even earlier. It might have been in the 80s. It was a study done. There's some kind of tropical fish off of Tasmania. And in this fish, the males have an orange component to the side on the markings of their side. And so what the experimenters did in that study was fascinating. I wouldn't have imagined that you would look for this in fish. So but this is what they had done. I believe I'm remembering the numbers pretty close to right. That what they did was they set up pairwise choices for female fish of this particular tropical fish variety. And what they would do is they would watch the following drama. And the drama was to have a guy with 17% of the side of his body, 17 or 18%, was this orange material, orange stripe type thing. And then they would pair that up with a male who had about 28 or 27 or 28%. And then what they would do is they would have, for some strange reason, in this particular species, I believe the species members can pick up the age of their conspecifics. So they know how old, they know that if a fish is older than they are. So what they had was they had young females observe older females And older females apparently, given the choice between the 18%er and the 28%er, they would choose the 18%er. And then when they let the young female in the tank and gave her the same choice between those same two males, she would choose the 18%er. So now this is in a situation where, all things being equal, without having been exposed to the older female making that choice, all of the fish would choose the 28%. So then what they did was they took about a 28%er and they put him in with, I think it was a 42%er. So a guy with a bit, gorgeous looking orange stripe on his side. And they did the same thing and they found exactly the same effect. In other words, they could cause the young female to choose Mr. 28% over Mr. 42% if she had observed an older female make that choice previously. So then they decided to test the limits, i.e. Danny DeVito versus Sean Connery, and they put the 18%er versus the 42%er and had the older female apparently choose the 18%er. They did this with smoke and mirrors. They were tricking the fish. And that did not work. So in that case, the younger females chose the 42%er. So there were limits to this, which was very interesting. So they weren't simply doing simple copying, but rather they were doing at least a two-factor decision-making process where they were taking into account other females of their species and their choice and adding those or multiplying or however it is that they do this, the math, along with their own judgment. So if this is happening in tropical fish, for God's sakes, it sure as heck happening everywhere else all over the animal kingdom. So this is going to be a very wide biological principle of how brains are going to function. So mating choices are very expensive choices. They're essentially the most important choices that animals make. And so it would make sense to not rely entirely on your own computer. Your own computer comes with little bells and whistles and mistakes and mutations that may make it a less than ideal decision-making mechanism. And that's why it's useful to ask other people what they think when you're about to make a big decision, just to check your own computer. So this is obviously a widespread device throughout the animal kingdom, and so it's hardly surprising that this is working in humans. So I can't believe that somebody got a publication out of such an easy and obvious thing that wasn't done before. But, it's cool to see it.
Yeah, the reason they had this study, and by the way, what I just learned from you is that since no woman will take a picture with me, I can at least take a picture with my fish, so put on my
there
dating
you go.
Profile.
With
yeah.
the big
but
stripe.
The,
big
with the big
stripe.
Yeah. Yeah. My sharp
right.
Sharpie can penetrate the water and go on the fish skin, right?
There you go.
Well, okay. So the reason the study was published was because they knew that there was this effect, but they didn't know to what extent and whether or not the girl was giving off cues that she was romantically interested in the male. So they studied this to determine whether there was the same effect if it was just any old female or if it was a female who was related or current girlfriend or ex-girlfriend. So that was the big difference between this study and all the previous ones.
Yeah, I had to read that study. There's some interesting details in there. It'd be interesting to see what the effect size was, just sort of how many percentile points up the scale he went. Very interesting, actually, and extremely. I'm not even joking about Match.com. In my intuition would be so that some guy that would take a picture with an attractive female standing next nearby would be essentially a deterrent, that he would look like he was too cool for school and wasn't smart enough to realize that this could be offensive. However, the truth is that seeing the person under a Match.com process where the male may be reaching out to the female, that could be a different social psychological situation than one where the female is simply observing a male who happens to be surrounded by or next to an attractive female. So it could be that you could be breaking some implicit covenant that you shouldn't be in a relationship with a competitor, et cetera, or that you shouldn't be trying to grandstand in such a way. So it could backfire, but somebody ought to actually do that research under those conditions, because that is a very important potential advantage that some savvy listeners of ours could use. There you go.
It's interesting. You're asking for the percentages, and I'm trying to pull them up here. But from what I remember, it was actually pretty significant for the non-related females. So the females who had been in relationships with the male, or were told.
Right.
I think they actually used the females who were ex-girlfriend or actual girlfriend of the guy, because mm-hmm. what they postulated was that the people in the experiment, the women, they could tell through some unobservable cues that mm-hmm. that the man and the woman in the picture were either close or adopted, you know, adopted brother, sister, or just, you know, cousin or something like that. So it was the girlfriend and the ex-girlfriend were the highest, and then it was the adopted sister and the cousin.
Very interesting. So got it. It would be interesting to see how obvious any of those little cues were, et cetera. Very interesting. Fascinating. Mm-hmm. I have to look at that. Mm-hmm. This goes to a wider principle. I actually call this whole concept of computer checking the fish trick. And this is what people are doing, throughout commerce and other things, that they are essentially signaling with cues of success that they are a good specimen and that they are under demand. And so if you are an attorney that has a very nice office, you are signaling that other people have paid you a lot of money for your services. So this is a fish trick. And it's the same thing with all kinds of social status issues. So driving a fancy car, living in a fancy house, these things are fish tricks. This is all about essentially suggesting that other people have found me very valuable and have traded a lot of their goods for my time. And so, therefore, conspicuous consumption is essentially a fish trick process where we're trying to gain what I'm going to call pseudo-esteem. So it isn't the same thing as esteem, because the person actually doesn't know what it is that you did that was supposed to be so great. They just know that other people must have thought so, or it's very likely that they did. And so, as a result, So pseudo-esteem doesn't mean that it's not without value or that it's phony. It simply means that it's not the same thing as actually knowing. That can be very useful and, in fact, critically important in marketing to suggest that others have found me useful and, therefore, it's very likely that you should too. This is the classic fish trick is, Trident gum. You know, 4 out of 5 dentist surveys said that we should buy Trident instead of other gum. That's there you go. All that is fish trick.
Mm-hmm.
All
it's
right.
Like my eye doctor.
Oh yeah,
it's
and
like...
I would say a rule. I have a little rule for conspicuous consumption, because there will be people that will say, "Oh my God, you know, the world is just so full of terrible waste and so on and so forth," and yet it's actually necessary to compete in a variety of social psychological markets. You are put in a position where if you do not display waste or conspicuous consumption, which is what it is. Obviously, you could do your work in a closet with a 100-watt light bulb and an old typewriter. You don't need a slick office with marble countertops. However, the issue is in order for people to believe that you can do your work well, you need to display reasonable cues that indicate that other people like them have made the choice that they're about to make. That's why I have what I'm going to call an 80% rule for conspicuous consumption. And that is that, if you can afford a house that's $500,000, you should be living in one that's $400,000. If you can afford a car that's $30,000, you should be driving a car that's $24,000. You don't need to live out to the limit of your abilities, which is what your genetic instincts will tell you to do. Your instincts will tell you to do that because everybody else is pushing as hard as they can on the fish trick to try to demonstrate superiority, you know, and popularity in that marketplace. But what we need to do is we need to advertise reasonably in order to capture not everybody you can get out of your market, but merely you want to get most of the people out of your market. In other words, you want to qualify on cursory imitative grounds. You'd like to qualify for most of the people who would be seeking out your services. Now, you won't get them all, because if you don't go to the nth degree and spend every last dime on your fish tricks, then you will be leaving some potential customers, mates, et cetera, friends in the street, because you will not have qualified, because there'll be competitors that are displaying more, and then you will be seen as a second-class citizen. So it will cost you some, but these are all probabilistic. These are all bell curves and probabilities. And so my general rule of thumb is that if you advertise, if you fish trick to 80% of what it is that you can reasonably afford, then you will capture most of your market, but you will be saving resources for an important other issues, specifically for savings in general. So you want to be saving a significant percentage of your resources, because in that way this puts you in what I call a position of power, where you are, where emergencies are much less threatening to you, and downturns, crises, unforeseen circumstances, unforeseen opportunities. By putting yourself in a position where you are consistently putting some money away, this is an important principle that enhances happiness, that is not incidentally part of the genetic code. So the genetic code doesn't tell you to save money. The genetic code will tell you that everybody else of your similar abilities is fish tricking as fast as they can with everything that they can get their hands on, and you will feel a little bit of a panic that you are being left behind. This is the push that people have. If they can, you know, if they can reasonably afford a $500,000 house, they're pushing it to get into something that's $575,000. This is human nature, and so this nature, this is part of beating your genes, is to actually understand what is driving the conspicuous consumption, grandstanding displays. Understanding that this is not silly and immature, that there are real live reasons why. If you're trying to date a cool girl, you better not be in a $15 pair of sunglasses. Okay, you don't need to be in a $200 pair of sunglasses, because that may be just flat out stupid. But you probably ought to be in a $50 pair of sunglasses. That's obviously only 25% of my 80% rule, but the principle stands that you want to be signaling at an appropriate level to get most of the market that you're interested in.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
That's enough for that.
That's enough for that. So sunglasses,
yeah.
My pet fish, and then online dating profile,
yeah.
I should be set. All right.
Okay.
Next topic. So new research replicates Stanley Milgram's findings. Now, Stanley Milgram, you're going to talk about in a little bit, but nearly 50 years after the controversial Milgram experiments, a social psychologist named Jerry Berger, PhD, has found that people are still just as willing to administer what they believe are painful electric shocks to others, urged on by an authority figure. So, Dr. Lyle, if you can take us through what the Stanley Milgram experiments were, and then a little bit about this new article that's come out.
Yes, the Milgram experiments are the most famous experiments in the history of psychology, and so, and I would argue in all of social science. So let me walk people through. A lot of people have heard them once in a Psych 101 class and know vaguely and can remember vaguely what it is, but actually, the experiment was very sophisticated, and it had some really fascinating conceptual dynamics that I don't think were particularly well understood in Milgram's day, and we can look back now and see them in perhaps a somewhat different, more enlightened viewpoint. Now, the Milgram study was essentially the following, that there was a Milgram who was the experimenter, and then you have a confederate, His name was James Madonna, and he was a chunky guy, round face, bald headed, glasses. I think he was 45 or so, but to me, he looks about 58 in the pictures. And Madonna was a gifted natural actor, and so he's going to play a victim. He's going to be making all kinds of screaming noises like he's being shocked to death, which, of course, he's not going to be getting anything of the kind. He may be getting little bitty shocks just to let him know that shocks were being administered, but he is purely acting. So everybody knows that there was no real shocks in the Milgram experiment. Actually, there was one real shock, and I'll tell you what that was. So there's Milgram, there's Madonna, and then the third person in the drama is, of course, the subject themselves. And the way this is set up is the people answer an ad in the newspaper for money. I think it was $4, which was real money. It'd be the equivalent of $40 now. This is in the early 1960s. And they come to the experiment, and what they have is they meet the experimenter. They ring a little bell or whatever it is, and Stanley Milgram comes out and greets the experiment, subject, and says, "Oh, well, you know, we're just getting some things set up in the back, actually, there's somebody else that's supposed to be in the study. We need two of you. He hasn't shown up yet." Now, this is a very important psychological gambit. Madonna is there, and he's in the back. But they wait until the actual person comes. Then Madonna sneaks out the back, and then a few minutes later walks in the front door. So now this makes makes the subject in the study feel like he is, if anything, he's on the in. He is certainly not. There's no possibility that Madonna and the experiment are in cahoots. So this is essentially drives any wedge of any setup completely out of their minds. In those days, nobody knew about psychology experiments, so they wouldn't have figured it out anyway. But Milgram didn't want to take any chances. So then Madonna winds up being chatty. So he's kind of chit-chatting in the waiting room. And he tells the person, he says, "Hey, shouldn't we tell the person that we're here?" And the guy says, "Oh, no, he said that it's going to take a few minutes, and so he'll be back out in a few minutes. No problem." So then Madonna says, "Oh, yeah, well, I've been down to the VA hospital. Turns out there's something a little wrong with my heart." So this is an important little that Madonna has a heart condition. He looks like he's fine, but he actually is admitting that he's been to the doctors and that they're concerned about a heart condition. All makes perfect sense. So then they go and the experimenter comes out. Milgram comes out and greets everybody and says, "All right, come on back." And then he says, "Hey, this is an experiment on learning and memory. And actually, this particular experiment is going to be on punishment and memory. And actually, there's been almost no studies done on punishment and memory. We've done studies on reward and memory. Like if we reward people for learning things, they learn things better. But, you know, it's kind of assumed that punishment would work the same way. So when we swat our children to get them to remember something, we assume that that's going to help. And when we punish criminals for when they do things wrong, we assume this is going to help. But we don't really know. And so this is going to be a study of learning and memory, but it's going to be specifically about punishment. And what it's going to be about is that one of you is going to be trying to learn these word pairs, and the other, that's going to be the learner, and the other one's going to be the teacher. And so the teacher's going to be reading off these word pairs to you over an intercom, and you've got to remember them and then try to say them back. And if you make a mistake, then the teacher is going to administer a shock. And the shocks, they might be painful, but they can't do any damage. And so we'll show the shock apparatus. So these people are going to be in two rooms next to each other, separated by a wall. And so they can hear each other through the wall. And on one side of the wall, there's going to be, they each have a desk to sit at. And one of the desks is going to be the desk of the teacher. And the teacher's desk is going to be a big old shock switchboard that's going to go from 15 volts to 450 volts. There's going to be gradations of 15 volts all along the way with these switches. So it's going to be 15, then 30, then 45, 60, 75, et cetera. And it's made of heavy gauge steel, and it has little dials with needles that as soon as you flip one of those switches, the needles go shk, shk. They quickly go to the right and to the left. And says Western Electric Company on it. So, and big old cord that goes through the wall to the other room. It's like very clear that this is legitimate. And so this is the shock switchboard, and this is the microphone, and here's the word list. And so you know, if you're the teacher, you're just going to say things through the intercom here. And if the learner gets it wrong, then you have to just flip these switches. That's what you do. Okay. And then we're going to go over to the next room, and we're going to see what the learner does. The learner also has a desk, and they have a chair at that desk, and they have electrodes coming through the wall, big old wires that we're going to attach to these people. And so that this is going to be the shock that's going to come through the wall. And they've got a microphone or intercom in order to say the words back. So what they're going to do is they're going to say, okay, well, one of you needs to be, we need to draw straws to figure out who's the teacher and who's the learner. And so it's going to be, so what they did is they have a hat, and in that hat they put two little strips of paper. And actually both strips say teacher. So there is not one that says teacher and one that says learner. And so Milgram is going to hand the hat to our subject, not to Madonna. And he's going to say, okay, well, how about you? Eeny, meeny. Okay, it's you. Go ahead and pick one of these things out of the hat. So the person picks it out of the hat and says teacher. So this is important because it just happens by chance that they got to be teacher. So it could have been them that was the learner. No problem.
What
so
a bunch of liars.
The learner. Yeah. So Madonna is the learner, and our guy, our subject, is the teacher. And what they do is they say, you know, actually, we need you to – we've already seen how the switchboard works, but we need everybody to understand what everybody else is going through and how they're doing this. So Mr. Jones here, what we need you to do is we need you to sit down, and we're going to hook you up just the way Mr. Madonna is going to be hooked up so you sort of see how his part works. And so they use electrical paste, and they hook him up, and they say, oh, we need to put some paste on you when we put the electrodes on there just to make sure that it helps to avoid blistering. Okay. So then they say, okay, well, we're going to give you we're going to give you a mild shock just to see so you see what's going on. And they go next door, and they flip the little switch supposedly for, I don't know, like 110 volts. That's a big bolt. I think it might have been 135. I can't remember what it was. But they give him a good blast. So this guy knows, oh, my God, this switchboard is totally alive, and these electrodes are totally alive. And they say, okay, that's good. Now, hold on just a second here. We're going to get you out of the chair. We're going to put Mr. Madonna in the chair. And they hook up Mr. Madonna, who's just fine with this. It's not like the person scowled at 110. They're like, whoa. You know, that'll give you a jump, same way if you put your finger in an electrical socket. It won't hurt you, but it'll freak you out. And so the person is well freaked out. They felt substantial current. And now they sit there and watch while they put these electrodes on Madonna and they paste them on him. Okay? And then what they're going to do once they put those electrodes on him, they're going to tie his hands down to the chair and his feet, I believe. And they say, well, we just have to put you in these restraints so that in case we don't want you overreacting to the shocks and maybe hurting yourself. Okay, so what we've got effectively is a prisoner.
Yeah.
Okay, so Madonna's just fine with this because it's an experiment. It's all cool. He happens to be the learner, not the teacher. So he's gonna sit right there at his desk with the intercom, and he's going to be listening carefully, try to get the words right, and no problem. So then Milgram is going to take our guy to the next room where the shock switchboard is, and Milgram is actually going to be there, and he's going to be sort of overseeing the study.
Now, quick question.
Yeah.
Can the learner, can they see each other, or is the wall solid?
No, the wall's solid.
They can only hear each other.
They can hear each other. Okay. So what's going to happen is that they're going to go through about three or four of these and word pairs like tree, branch, et cetera, and our guy's going to get them all right, no problem. Madonna's going to get everything right. And then he's finally going to make a mistake. And so he makes a mistake. And the experimenter says, or Milgram will say to the teacher, say, go ahead, give him 15 volts, just no problem. And they go on, and then finally Madonna makes him another mistake. He says, okay, give him 30. gives them 30, and they go on and give them 45 and 60. I believe it was at 75 that Madonna makes his first reaction that we hear, and he'll just do a simple grunt, like they throw the switch, and Madonna will say, like that. Okay? That's all. And then they go on, they do 90, and then they get to 105, and I think at about 105 or 120, Madonna says, hey, this is too painful. I can't do this. And then the experimenter, or excuse me, the subject will typically turn to Milgram and say, hey, that's too painful. And Milgram will say simply, please go on. Okay? And invariably, the person will turn back to the thing, read another thing, read some more words. Madonna will make a mistake, go up to the next one. Now we're at, 135. And Madonna bitches again. He's like, hey, I can't handle this. Okay? And they'll turn to they may turn to Milgram again, and Milgram will say, the experiment must continue. Okay? So it's going to turn out that at each level, very often the people would just continue on for quite a while up the switchboard. I think when they got to the 180s or so, Madonna would start pounding on the wall, like, hey, get me out of here. And if they went on, as most people did, all the way into the 270s or so, Madonna would be screaming in agony every time. And then he would stop responding altogether. And if the people would turn to Milgram and say, hey, that guy's in trouble, shouldn't we check? Milgram would say, please go on. And then so he's going to have four prompts that he's going to say each time that there's an objection. So if the person says, hey, he's in real trouble, he's got a heart condition, please go on. Well, no, I really don't think I should. The experiment must continue. Okay? I can't continue. You have no choice. The experiment must go on. There's four prompts, and the final one is you have no choice. This gets all the way to where Madonna no longer responds and says any words, and the Milgram will turn on an objection from the subject and say, treat a non-response as an error. The experiment must go on. Okay? Now, this will go, remember, there's now 30 switches on this board. And underneath these switches are described, like, for example, in the early going, it says mild shock at, 90. Okay, then it says moderate shock at 150 or so. Strong shock at, 220. Very strong shock at, 330. And then all the way at the far end of the board is 450. And it says it has triple X. Okay, after it's, extreme danger, extremely strong shock, and then it has triple X, i.e. it's very clear you killed him. Now, the question is, how far will people go? That was the great question in the Milgram study. And it turns out that about 65% of people go all the way to triple X. To say that this shocked the world of social science is a massive understatement. And I don't often have roll my eyes at colleagues in social psychology, but I have seen behind a lot of PR, which is fine. Phil Zimbardo's famous Stanford Prison Study is supposed to be equivalent or very mm-hmm. exciting and fascinating relative to the Milgram study. This is bogus. Okay, there is no study like the Milgram study. The Milgram study is conceptually the most fascinating, most important study I think that I have ever seen, and I haven't seen anything close. The this completely exonerates any of the hoodlums and citizens that were running Auschwitz other than the people at the top. This is showing you that I can take an average guy off the street, literally an average human being, and I can have them commit a murder, and I can do it within half an hour. Two out of three of them will do it. With nothing more than a lab coat and the promise of $40 to do an experiment. Now, this seems impossible that this would be true. But if we're going to figure this out, we have to sort of get over our outrage and try to look at this. And if we look at it from the standpoint of evolutionary psychology, I think it's going to make a lot of sense. So we have to understand why, what is happening here. And what Milgram called it was obedience to authority. And that's good. That's a very good description of this. But we would now say, wait a second, it's obedience to alpha. So what we're seeing is that human beings are inherently sensitive to change the command and to essentially do what alpha says. And in this case, what happened was that it was because of some of the elegant methods by which Milgram used, it worked beautifully. So you start out by essentially doing a small thing, and then it makes it difficult for you to ever draw the line and say, well, if I did 105, you know, why shouldn't I do 120? And it makes it difficult for the person to figure this out. What point should they draw the line? There's no obvious demarcation of when that should happen. Another thing is that you're getting social pressure from alpha. And so alpha is saying, basically, in a sense, telling you, you are doing what you're supposed to be doing. And through that, through those social cues, the person amazingly follows through against their better judgment. So what we have here is a crisis of what I'm going to call a crisis of integrity. So what integrity is the method by which your behavior follows your best judgment. And your best judgment means, did you integrate all of the relevant values of the problem, and did you give them appropriate weight? When you don't give them appropriate weight, you make a mistake of integrity. And in doing so, you are doing something that is not in the best interest of the organism. And so the organism is designed by nature to behave with integrity, and it behaves with integrity almost all the time. So you behave with integrity. Now, I know that you don't, Nate, but most people do.
How did you know I ate some almond ice cream yesterday? How did you know?
So the point is that you naturally behave with integrity because you are built to do so. So if you go for a long, hard walk on a cold day and you're hungry and you're tired and you're thirsty and you're cold, when you walk through the door of the little cabin, you have four different targets of action. You have water, food, warmth, and lying down. And the question is, which should you do? And your brain is designed by nature to put those things in order of biological value. And so you may be much thirstier than you are hungrier, or you may be much colder than you are thirsty. And so you will actually answer the bell according to your gene's best way to build neural circuits that are sensitive to threats to your survival, and they need to juxtapose those in appropriate order. That's what a brain is. It doesn't do any good for a brain to, quote, have things that it values if it doesn't know how to put them side by side and to analyze them and figure out which one is the most important. So that is what it means to have a brain that is integrated neural circuits, that it's designed by nature to do values integration so that it answers the most important thing first. Now, the situation is complex, even as you walk through the door of the cabin. And that is because it's going to turn out that all of those four targets are not equally difficult to do. So it may be that the fireplace is closer. It may be that somebody's handing you a glass of water, but you're unbelievably famished, so you walk right past the water and go right into the kitchen for the food. I'm not sure. It may be that you just don't have any energy at all, and you're just going to stagger on the ground and not eat or drink anything for a while, but you will be in the warmer cabin, and you will now recover that first. I don't know what you're going to do. We will find out what the appropriate, most integrated solution is by simply observing your behavior. But in the case of the Milgram study, what happens is that we get a clash of values. And one of those values is Madonna's life. And the other value is I'm supposed to do what Alpha says. Those two things are headed for a collision course. Now, from all the analysis that I've read in the Milgram study, I don't hear anybody try the thought experiments that I think would show very clearly how the Milgram study is actually working. So actually, Lee Ross and Dick Nisbet, two prominent social psychologists, actually proposed one interesting little variant of the Milgram experiment that was near and dear to their heart about the concept of what we're going to call channel factors. And that is, suppose that at the beginning of the study, you said, okay, and if at any time in the study there's a little red button here on the desk, for any reason you can hit that red button and stop the study. So if that were true, Nisbet and Roth say, we think the results would be entirely different. So we really think that it's not about obedience to authority. It's about the inability to be disobedient, because the people were actually trying to stop the study and objecting to the guy, to Milgram, but they couldn't manage to pull it off. Now, I actually disagree with the Nisbet and Ross analysis. I think their analysis is very, very interesting, and I respect the heck out of both those guys. I think they're both alive, and they're both really smart. But I actually think that they have actually misunderstood that the issue here is a Stone Age kowtowing to alpha in an emergency, that your own gene's best interest is to do what alpha says in an emergency. And if you say that there's a chicken switch on the top, that there's a red button, that you can contradict alpha, then you've said he's not alpha. Somebody else was alpha. Whoever made the rules of the chicken switch is there at your disposal for your own choice is alpha, not the guy that's telling you you must continue. So I think that the Nisbet and Ross analysis actually misses the fundamental issue as to what's happening here. What we have is a Stone Age clash between what we're going to call an honorary friend, which is somebody he just met, and human beings treat each other as honorary friends until proven otherwise. So Madonna is definitely an honorary friend. He's been totally friendly, totally affable, nothing indecent about Madonna at all. So you would treat him as an honorary friend. And now we have alpha, that you have accepted a role of being under alpha's guise here, that you're supposed to do what alpha says. Now, what alpha says is ludicrous, but he's sort of got you into it a little bit at a time. So it's a little bit hard for you to figure out how you're going to get out of it. And it's going to turn out, when you sound out reasonable objections, he's got you beat. He's got the answers for them. And it intimidates you into continuing. This is a mistake. The system was not well enough designed to figure this one out. This is a very novel evolutionary problem, and as a result, the system is in confusion. And Milgram set it up just well enough that the average nervous system defaults to the most dominant Stone Age circuit, which says you better do what alpha says in the emergency. So I want to propose some changes in the Milgram experiment that would clearly demonstrate what it is that I'm talking about. Suppose that the person that you meet at the study is not Madonna. Suppose it's your 17-year-old son or daughter. So the two of you come in as a pair, and you are assigned to be the teacher and they are the learner, and you start shocking them and they say, I can't stand the pain. What happens now? Does anybody in their right mind think that this experiment continues? I don't think so. I think 100% of people stop, which tells us exactly what's going on here, that Madonna has a certain survival value, gene survival value to our individual, and as they, depending upon who that is, they're computing that gene survival value, and as soon as we make that gene survival value high, it's done. In fact, if it was a friend, I think it's done. Okay? So it's very interesting. What we're really demonstrating is how little survival value strangers have to us. So that's one thing that's being demonstrated. Another thing that would be demonstrated would be the following, and that is that actually piggybacking accidentally on what we just talked about earlier, which is what I'm going to call the fish trick, and the imitative mechanisms or the computer checking mechanisms that are natural to human beings. Suppose, for example, that halfway through this study that Milgram said to our subject, he said, you know what? We're actually out of time for today. We're at 220 volts right now. What I'd like to do is I'd like you to come back tomorrow morning And we'll pick up in the middle of this where we are, and we'll continue the experiment later. Okay? How many people do you think are going to come back? How many people do you think, in fact, are going to get out of there, and they're going to go home, and they're going to talk to their friends, and their friends are going to say, what the hell are you talking about? That guy's a madman. You need to call the cops. Okay? I think the odds of anybody coming back the second day and resuming at 220 volts are zero, which is actually telling us that this is an extraordinary situation where the person is caught without a social frame of reference for checking alpha's action. And so as a result, we've stripped a situation down to an evolutionary novel situation where they're simply following the one circuit that's in there, which is you better do what alpha says. And so for me, this reminded me of a lot of jams that I worked in the prisons for 10 years. And my guys in the prisons would get backed into a corner by prison gang dynamics. They'd be in a lot of trouble. And they would get pushed to do some things that are dangerous, unethical, illegal, make it impossible for them to leave prison, et cetera. And so they would start to get into tough situations just like this. And what I would tell them is, your first move is you have to get out of the situation. You have to buy some time. You have to I'll talk to you this afternoon. And then you got to go get a second opinion, and you got to talk to some people. Because you got to have the second opinion say, wait a minute, tell me the whole story again. And in this way, you get yourself out of the situation. This is how to stop major mistakes in terms of your own personal ethics or your own integrity, that when you're in a bind and you're feeling an emergency and you're feeling under a lot of pressure under a situation, the right thing to do is to figure out how to delay it. You get out of there, and then the second thing you do once you get a delay is you actually get some input from somebody that you respect, okay, that is completely independent of the situation. And those are two ways to help you not make breaches of integrity that you don't want to make. All right?
So nowadays, it's very unlikely for something like this to happen. Just because someone has a problem, they'll go on Instagram, Facebook, social media, ask a question, and then within minutes, there's going to be a hashtag with all kinds of people opinionating about what to do.
That's actually good. There could be the classic situation in Vietnam was the My Lai massacre. And when Lieutenant Calley was, he was the one that shouldered the major court-martial blame, et cetera. And essentially he said, hey, I was doing what I was told to do. And certainly the guys under him were doing what they were told by him to do. And so there's still going to be situations where a person is going to be feeling pressure, and they're not going to know that the two steps are get out by any sort of delay, and then number two, go seek advice. And those are the two. So I'm not discounting what you just said. I think that the more people are able to pass their decisions through other brains, I think the better. But it's good to identify in principle what the Milgram study really did for us. Was it highlighted for us the limitations of our own integrity. And it also showed us that if you prepare for integrity challenges, you can be better. So if you actually understand, just like preparing for a fire drill in your house with your kids, in the same way, it's very useful to have some pretty firm principles about how it is that you're going to handle, ethical, moral, et cetera, emergencies. And one of them is going to be, I am going to delay this situation, no matter what. No matter how much pressure I'm under, I am going to find a way to delay. That's the first thing I'm going to do. And the second thing I'm going to do is I'm damn well going to get some input from somebody with some brains. And that, not only for emergencies, but for general problems, more general problems that people face. That is also a way to reduce the likelihood that you have actually got your values a little bit askew, and therefore you're going to wind up with some kind of breach of integrity.
Fantastic.
All right.
All right. Yeah. In Berger study, they didn't go past the 150 volts because they felt that it would traumatize the teacher in that experiment.
Right. So, yes. I understand. Yes. It turns out Milgram followed up his people for years behind this. And the Milgram study was largely responsible for a sort of a major new revolution in worrying about the impact of the experiment on psychological subjects. And so then it became more difficult to get studies through ethics committees with definitely justification as far as this goes. It got to be ridiculous now to the point where, you know, if we have some little study with a little bit of negative feedback that might cause somebody a little bit of a negative mood, you know, the whole ethics committee looks at that thing upside down. So it gets more difficult to do some of these interesting deceptive experiments, which actually will show us some interesting things about human nature. Understandably, the Milgram study should, you know, these days, if you ever redo it, it should be done with limits so that people don't think that they discover that they would have killed the guy. That's not the greatest thing to live with. It turns out I don't think it was particularly problematic for the people in the Milgram study, and many of them appreciated the fact that they were in the study because they learned something about themselves, about their own natural limitations, and therefore to watch out for them. And so at any rate, that however, good for them. I'm glad they did it right.
Fantastic. All right. So
all right.
Moving on to we have some news from the Herald. There's a 39-year-old weightlifter, Laurel Hubbard, who dominated the competition while competing in the Australian International Weightlifting Competition. Representing New Zealand, Hubbard destroyed her competition in her division. She set 4 records in the process. Turns out Laurel's a transgender woman. She emerged last year as an international caliber lifter. But before then, she had competed nationally as Gavin Hubbard, her birth name.
Yeah.
After transitioning in her mid-30s, Hubbard apparently started to find a lot more success in the weightlifting field as a woman.
Oh, for goodness sakes. You know, I just have to say the obvious in case nobody else is saying it. This is ludicrous. Okay, so obviously we cannot be having international world record recognized bodies having X males sex change to females and then competing. This is ridiculous. So obviously the Olympic Committee, and if they haven't already passed a decision on this, they're going to have to, because somebody is just wacky enough to go to no lengths to get a gold medal. So ludicrous. All right. Notice that not a single female changing to a male is desiring to compete against males. This is clearly a fiasco, and it makes a mockery out of female sports. Females should not be competing against males unless they want to, and it's openly acknowledged that it is a mixed competition. But this is just sheer insanity, and somebody's going to have to call it what it is and say that is not a genetic female. That is a whatever we want to call it. It can live its life as a female. Great. I wish it great happiness, but it doesn't get to compete in our sanctioned athletic competition against females. Forget it. Oh, well, the world's going to finally have to wake up to this.
One of my friends a couple of years ago, when Caitlyn Jenner won the Woman of the Year, he sent me a text and he said, yeah, this just proves that men are better than women at everything, including being a woman.
That's very, very clever. All right.
No,
very
I'm
good.
Just kidding.
My heart goes out. My heart goes out to everyone who struggles with these issues and goes through whatever they need to do to try to get more peace of mind and sort of to find themselves. That's all fine with me, but it shouldn't be on a wrestling match or a weightlifting competition. That's not where you're not going to be welcome there. Not in my judgment.
I completely agree. I know a couple acquaintances who are transgender, and they're wonderful people. And like you said, they struggle in their own way, but the weightlifting thing a little bit much. So.
All right. Well, we're getting close out of time. You got anything fun?
Oh yeah, we're just about ready to go with the Darwin Awards. Are you ready, Dr. Lyle?
I'm ready.
All right. Let's see here. Okay. So. We have our runner-up. Now, in order to win a Darwin Award, you have to actually take yourself away from the Jane pool. This guy got close. A 66-year-old Netherlands resident, he wanted to protect his garden shed against burglars. So the best way to do this, he decided, was to construct a booby trap. So he put together some ropes and then a shotgun aimed at his door. And he was so proud of his invention that when his friends came over, he decided to demonstrate the effectiveness of the device. So he pretended to be a burglar, burst through the door, and promptly got shot in the abdomen and the lower arm. Luckily, an emergency operation prevented him from winning a Darwin Award.
But he gets an honorable mention. That's very good.
No.
All right, so are you ready for the actual Darwin Award for this evening?
Yes.
All right, Iraqi terrorist Kai Ranjanet decided to send a letter bomb in 2000. He wasn't the brightest of sparks, so he forgot to put enough postage on the letter, meaning it came back to him, returned to sender. But he was so happy to receive some mail that he ripped it open. And his career in terrorism ended right then and there.
That was that. I hope these things are. Oh my goodness. The world is a better place for him getting that award. That's good.
Were you saying, I hope these things are what?
I said, I can't remember what I was thinking. It's gone.
Oh, fantastic.
All right.
Dr. Lyle, thanks again for your fantastic, tremendous insight. We will talk to you next week.
Very good. Great fun, Nate. I'll see you soon.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.